This is tape 5 of the PDH online course, Industrial HVAC Controls. We're going to start talking about plant air compressors, and it was a little bit of a stretch to do this, so I copied a diagram from a website. Let's see, I told you the website. I try to be honest and straightforward by this. fluidenergy.com/images03lubecompdes.gif. And I just looked at the way this is published by PDH in the PDF form, and I think it came out very readable. I'm so pleased with the work those people provide at the home office. A typical 1950 air compressor and each of the accessories you needed by 1993 was a packaged unit, though all the components were exposed. The manufacturers made all the sizing and materials decisions in order to meet the performance specifications. In 2009, it was still a packaged unit, but there was a shiny painted enclosure with a window to see the controls. The shiny painted enclosure helped meet the OSHA workplace noise limitation. The following sketch reports the components of a small plant air compressor. Now, what's small about it? A big air compressor goes from the floor to the ceiling. This is one that has a good-sized air receiver on it and a good-sized compressor sitting on top of it so it goes to the ceiling. So it's about half the height of a big air compressor. And it's still industrial. It's not the sort of thing you would have in your basement or running the auto lift in your neighborhood garage. We have two air compressors. Is that a surprise? I don't think so. In this presentation, there are two air receivers, each having an air compressor on top of them. The receiver on the compressor has an automatic drain on it, because you just collect a lot of water in your air receiver. If you think about compressing air that has a lot of moisture in it, you compress the air, but you don't compress the moisture. And through the laws of... there's a name in that chart that tells you how much moisture air can hold. Anyway, the moisture precipitates out in the tank, and they have an automatic blowdown on the thing. It shows air intake and a relief on the compressor. Then there are two compressors. Each have a discharge going into a check valve, a service valve, and the manifold. Now, why have a check valve? Well, that's so you can leave both of them sitting there all the time and not mess with it, but only the one in service supplies air into the manifold. Service valve is so you can shut the thing down completely to work on it. You don't want high-pressure compressed air coming back in your face while you're working on it. From the common raw air manifold, they go into an aftercooler, and this is just shown as a radiator with a fan on it, so it tries to bring it down to the ambient temperature in the machine room. After that is a moisture separator. After that is a split. The main flow goes through two coalescing filters in series, a desiccant air dryer, a particulate filter, a vapor filter with a dew point analyzer on it, then comes back together to go into the plant air receiver. You might think of this as finished air because it's been cleaned up considerably. I said there was a split. The main flow is through all the filters. There is a bypass so you can take the filters out of service to work on them. I just unscrew the glass bowl and wipe it out and then put it back online. I am doing something that is not in the published picture and not really all that common in industry, but I feel very strongly about it. I'm putting a limit switch on the bypass valve so you get an alarm when it's in bypass mode. You really don't want running raw air out into the plant. It's just not good for the system. It's not good for the operators. It's a bad thing. So I've put a limit switch on the bypass valve. And the compressed air goes out into the plant. Then it mentions, let me read what it says. The compressor is shown with as an integrated unit mounted on top of an air receiver. Note the sound enclosures. Two complete independent compressors are shown. There is a silencer on the compressor air intake. The compressor has a regulator not shown and an ASME relief valve on the line to the receiver. The receiver has an automatic water drain and a diaphragm emergency relief. Two compressor systems are manifolded with check valves so that both can be online normally. The manifold is followed by an aftercooler with a fine moisture separator. The aftercooler is followed by a precision dryer with several other filters and instrumentation. This can be bypassed to keep the plant online if there are problems with the filters. The compressor manifold and cleanup services are followed by a major plant air receiver with another ASME relief and another inline filter. Not shown is the fact that the compressors operate at 150 to 200 PSI, and the plant usually runs about 100 PSI. There will be individual filters, lubricators, and regulators at each machine or tool. The machines and tools typically require 60 PSI. The question for the controls designer is, what items deserve enunciator alarms? Typically, high discharge header pressure, low discharge header pressure, and a filter bypass, limit switch on the bypass valve. A water level switch in the first receiver sounds like a good idea, but I haven't seen them installed. The reasoning is that when you have a machine or process problem, you want to see if it was preceded by a compressed air problem. A latched alarm gives you gross indication that something was going on, but a strip chart is better and an alarm log with time date stamped to the fraction of a second is best. The limitation of the strip chart, beyond constant attention to pens and paper, is slow speed, precluding precise timing to the minute. This brings up the first and second major questions of the 2009 relocation design and the future 2010 HMI design. Now let me restate that. The reason I want to restate that is I know there's a test question. I think the test question is a little confusing, and maybe this paragraph was confusing in its own right. You expect to have disturbances in your compressed air system. When the disturbances are great enough to tip the alarm, you get an event log notification that something bad had happened at 12:01 a.m. on Thursday. If you've got the strip chart, you get each of the bumps and the bigger bump that caused the alarm at 12:01 on Thursday. Now, does the enunciator give you this? Well, it tells you there was an alarm, doesn't tell you when. An alarm log, which is something we haven't mentioned yet, is a digital recording of what time and date it took place. It's got a time date stamp on it. Actually, for a short time, they put these on printers, but it just didn't work. It took too much paper, and you were recording too many things you really weren't interested in. And the paper record didn't hold up very well, even though we're still installing them today. So, again, the question is, do you want an enunciator? Do you want an event log? Do you want a strip chart? And the answer is, the event log is probably the best, and something digital relating to the strip chart would be better than a strip chart. The strip chart, in order to get 24 hours on a reasonable amount of paper, it is so slow, you don't get resolution to the minute. You know something happened. It's certainly valuable, but you can't distinguish if it happened before or after the process disturbance. First question, can we duplicate the strip chart function in the PLC? The cost and hassles of a strip chart are substantial, but the value is real. Same value with no incremental cost makes the designer a hero. That is, if we can do it on the PLC, ain't that keen? We don't have to buy a strip chart and we don't have to fuss with it. Second question, can we get an alarm log with time date stamped to the fraction of a second from the PLC? And again, very valuable information that was not available previously. If it's a no-cost feature, it's certainly a good idea. So let's talk about the Nematron. We are speculating that the revision between 1993 and 1994, which added the Nematron, had a justification for engineering time and capital cost. The first speculation is the addition gave the control room operators a better insight into HVAC and pump room operations. Also, it gave an operator who had a password the ability of changing the facility operation from just outside the control room. It's also certain that the designer was thinking of storing alarms in the PLC and using the Nemotron to display them with time date stamps. Similarly, the capability existed to store a series of values for header air pressure, for instance, and bring them back after an upset. In 1994, this was possible, but it was difficult. Let me go one step further. It was very difficult. The difficulties were the lack of provided routines for the functions and the very, very limited memory available in the PLC. Now, we haven't talked about the internals of a PLC, and we're really not going to, but what it does is it combines the instructions into very concise words, and these words are commands that execute within the PLC. So when you bought an early PLC, you bought so many words of memory. And of course, the more words of memory you had, the bigger program you could put in it. But what is the scale of these numbers? Scale of these numbers is 1K words or 2K words. Maybe a big PLC would have 20K of memory. Well, if you've done any work with data acquisition, each data value requires one word. So you're not going to store 20,000 data values if all you've got is 20,000 locations for your entire program. How much can you store? Well, 10 or 50. I mean, those kind of numbers become reasonable. More than that does not become reasonable. And again, they were not done with prepared logs. You had to store the value into a register and then retrieve the value from a register. If we're talking 20 values to simulate a strip chart, you had to have a routine to store 20 values sequentially and retrieve 20 values and output them for display. The 1994 Model 120 Nemotron did not have a alarm log or trending capability. It was a kludge never implemented. Now, what do I mean there? I mean, it was a good idea. I mean, they were going the right direction. They were trying hard. But it wasn't implemented. And again, being 15 years ago, we have to guess why it wasn't implemented. Well, it cost a lot of money. It was several thousand dollars for a Nemotron. It wasn't a cheap machine, even back when the money was a little more valuable. If you needed it, there was a bargain. If you were trying to convince people it would be valuable to them, they could think of other places they could spend a few thousand dollars. The 2009 Nemotron is advertised as including alarm log and trending capability. Unfortunately, no one at the Nemotron representative or home office know anything about it. Before the HMI scope change landed, the secret plan of the Relocation 2 controls designer was to specify an OIT which included alarm log and trending, and to include the OIT programming in the expected PLC programming work. How this worked out is the story promised in part two of the course. No alarm log or trending in 1994. Monitoring process gases and sulfur dioxide. They're called process gases because the process needs them to produce good product. That's why the original design included strip charts for pressure and alarms for high pressure and low pressure on each. Sulfur dioxide is special for two reasons. In large quantity, it blocks the sense of smell, then it kills you. Blocking the sense of smell is important to the industrial hygienist and to the controls engineer because it argues against the intuitive response, "We'll smell it and get out of there." By the way, if you've encountered sulfur dioxide, it has a very distinctive odor. Except in large quantities, it freezes your nose before you ever get that sensation. No, the first breath of concentrated SO2 blocks the smell capability. It doesn't kill you immediately, but you need to know you are in trouble to know to get out of there. This is reason for the toxic gas alarm, which is needed for this process, but not present in 1994 or 2009. Sidebar discussion. I'm reading this and trying to figure out what was the reasoning going on when this went down on paper. Let me read it as it's written. It is a controls engineering responsibility to get a written statement from the client that they don't want an SO2 alarm. The reason I paused there was, it seems like, and this is the kind of thing my fingers do sometimes, it could have been, is it a controls responsibility to get a written statement? But it's presented in the affirmative. Why is that? Because your author also writes the ethics course for PDH Online. And ethics says you don't let people get killed when you knew about it without taking a reasonable amount of engineering effort. So the way it is written in today's course, it is a controls engineering responsibility to get a written statement from the client that they don't want an SO2 alarm. Is there a question regarding the toxicity of SO2? Is there a question regarding the quantity available for sudden release? Is there a question regarding the block smell feature of SO2? Is there a question about commercially available toxic gas alarms? Is there a question of this effort restricting future design contracts with this client? And those answers are not provided here, though in the links and references section, there are several manufacturers of toxic gas alarms listed. And I've done work on projects where they have very extensive alarm systems. You can buy alarms in various forms. Simplest form is you buy an alarm, you plug it in, it's an alarm. You've seen this at home with a carbon monoxide detector. The next step up is you buy an alarm and plug it in, and it's an alarm. But it has a relay contact that goes into a central location. So if everybody's dead out in the north wing, you know to call the EMS and start heading south. That wasn't funny. I wish I hadn't said that. Reliability of large control panels, operator interaction terminals, and human-machine interface terminals. Experience indicates that large control panels, fabricated of steel enclosures and heavy-duty oil-tight operators, last almost forever. The components do not wear in any noticeable fashion. However, the nameplates change to felt marker notation and the lamps are always burning out. It's not uncommon to have additional buttons and lights added by sloppy field installation or in another steel box bolted to the side of the first. Large control panels have operated American industry for the 60 years I've been making observations, and historic installations back to the 30s. I see a lot of open switchboards in use before then, and let's not pursue that. Nematrons and OIT of competitive manufacturers, especially Allen Bradley Panelview, were introduced shortly after the PLC. People noticed that an awful lot of plant operation could be done from the programming console. This operation and initial adjustments were done during commissioning. Why not find a reliable way to make a restricted form of PLC access available to plant operators? The early OIT were easy but tedious for PLC programmers to set up and change when they changed the PLC program. They were not easy for plant maintenance people to update. The big problem was the point list. The nature of computers, both the PLC and the OIT, is to handle numbers. Field device contacts, coils, and such are connected to input and output points of the computer. Each gets a unique number for internal processing. The point list relates the English name and perhaps tag number of a field device to the input card terminals and the internal number used for the PLC stuff. It is just marginally tolerable if you have a good memory. The early OIT had a new point list relating the input numbers, the calculated PLC numeric storage registers, and the English name and perhaps the tag number. Until very recently, it was necessary to convert among the point lists. The numeric names had to be typed. Cut and paste didn't work. Drag and drop hadn't been invented. Keep in mind that the early OIT was as reliable as a PLC, and it had no disastrous failure modes. They died gracefully. They just quit working. It was common to have more than one in different locations and easy to unplug it from one location, plug it into another location, or air freight in a replacement unit and configure it for operation. HMI is a sexy version of OIT. It has a bigger, better computer, more memory, usually a much larger screen, and often a touch screen. It does not have the reliability of a PLC, and there's a problem with having duplicate machines online together. The manufacturers insist on a master-slave arrangement. This means that when the master goes down, the system goes down. Standby HMI must be reprogrammed or reconfigured as a master. This is not something you want your third shift operator doing. The IT-centric version of the HMI is the HMI server. Everything looks like an OIT or HMI installation. The PLC runs the fans and pumps and compressors and such. The control system talks digitally to the PLC and extracts value from input points, output points, and register values. It can provide input commands and enter register values as recipe targets or whatever. The HMI server is a first-class computer, almost always in the information technology kingdom. Remote HMI client PCs get input, output, and register information from the HMI server. The remotes can send commands and recipe targets. There can be many remote clients, even internet browser access. In addition, the HMI server nicely links to a corporate database. It's convenient and valuable to make available data for monthly EPA reports, EPA disturbance reports, daily, weekly, and monthly operation reports. In fact, corporate or contract engineers can access the HMI server with little chance of causing a process upset while doing historic troubleshooting. Some view the major benefit of the HMI server of being in the IT kingdom. Only IT technicians can have access to the hardware and software. Depending on who has responsibility for EPA reports, this may be a good thing. IT certainly has well-honed skills in protecting turf and balancing the needs of management, operations, and maintenance. Now, I'm going to have some contrary comments when I come back following this break.